For the record, my name is Anthony Urey. I represent the plaintiff in this matter, Ronald Johns. This case represents a case that went to a jury trial, and plaintiff has filed an appeal following a defense verdict. The issues on appeal, I'll go first with the issue with respect to denial of a jury instruction represented by the case of Mitchell v. Trawler Racer, which I believe is a seminal case in maritime law. Plaintiff argued at trial that transitory conditions, even those that exist for a few moments, can render a vessel unseaworthy. In support of that evidence, one of the last exhibit in plaintiff's excerpts is the Coast Guard video. The Coast Guard was hovering over the vessel, lowering pumps to save the vessel after a mayday had been called, while the crew had their survival suits on. Plaintiff was denied that jury instruction, the transitory language. It's stated precisely in my reply brief, number 4. Plaintiff was entitled to a jury instruction indicating that transitory conditions, even those that exist only for a few moments, may cause unseaworthiness. That denial was harmful error because that was a theory of plaintiff's case. The Misty Blue was unseaworthy for approximately 2 to 3 hours.
So your theory was that even if the boat was seaworthy at the time it left the dock, it became unseaworthy later? Was that it, or?
No one precisely knows when that hose clamp loosened up to a point where all the fresh water was automatically pumped by the pump and filled the forepeak. But they do know when the boat instantaneously went to a 30-degree list, there was something seriously wrong. The captain called a
mayday. How long did it take from the time the boat left the dock until it went over the
About 12 hours, approximately. They left King Cove, Alaska. This happened about 60 miles, I believe, south of St. Paul Island, or St. George Island. Approximately 12 hours of sailing. The boat instantaneously, without warning, without notice to anybody, went to a 30-degree list. The captain called a mayday. The Coast Guard arrived in short order with pumps, took the video. The rail was under, the exhibit shows the starboard rail underwater, the bow down. Following that, the undisputed evidence at trial was that the captain instructed Ronald Johns to go down to the engine room to restart the motor for the steering. The captain, the testimony in the excerpt show that the captain, who was the prior engineer for a year, went down, restarted the generator, the loss of electricity, because the fuel was starved because of the list. He went down and restarted the generator, forgot to restart the steering motor, told Ron Johns, who was up in the wheelhouse, go down and restart that motor. Ron says, I had my survival suit on. The boat was at a 30-degree list. I slipped down the stairs, hit the galley floor. My adrenaline was going. I went to the engine room, followed the orders, came back to the wheelhouse. The captain then told me to go on deck and start getting rid of the crab pots that were stacked there on the starboard side to level the boat. He followed that order. The undisputed testimony was that he used a small cheater bar, the only tool that was available on deck, used all the strength and got the first pot loose because the other pots were pushing on it when the boat was laying over. He felt a second back pain. He says the first back pain was when he hit the floor in the galley floor. The second back pain was when he was got done jettisoning that pot. Now,
can I ask you a question about this temporary unseaworthiness issue? As I understand the problem, the reason the boat listed in the first place was because of the loose hose clamp, which allowed water to leak into, I guess, this front of the boat? Or?
Yeah, but they call it the forepeak. It's a compartment up forward, a storage, huge storage compartment. That water was to be stored in its own storage tanks.
All right, but factually, it seems that both parties agree that that loose hose clamp existed when the boat left the dock.
Well, no one knows exactly when the hose clamp became that loose or when it loosened.
Well, what I understand that Misty Blue argued was that they had had some maintenance and a repair on that hose, and that they seem to be arguing that it was your client's responsibility to have looked at that before the ship left the dock. So if you go with their theory and accept their theory, then that all the damage was caused by the loose hose clamp, then it was unseaworthy when it left the dock.
Well,
that's their theory.
Their theory was that somebody, and they opined it must have been Mr. Johns, who loosened the hose clamp.
Well, didn't they say he neglected to check it before they left? And he said that wasn't my responsibility. I wasn't the engineer.
The only witness that was called by the defense, the vessel owner, was a witness who was not there. He was the prior captain, Herb Ferencoff.
Right.
He opined that it must have been this person. But the only direct testimony at trial was that from Mr. Johns, who said, I was rigging crab pots away from the vessel. My uncle, who was the captain and the prior engineer, took care of getting the vessel ready. That's the only direct testimony at trial. Now, plaintiff made an offer of proof because Captain Johns was available to testify. He waited in the hallway for a day. A defense doctor was called out of order. He had high blood pressure. It's in his affidavit. It was part of the motion for reconsideration, also a motion for a new trial. He came back 2 days later to testify as a rebuttal witness. He was not allowed. The offer of proof was, in his affidavit, was that this did not happen this way. In other words, he states clearly.
Well, that offer of proof came with the affidavit in connection with the motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, didn't it?
Well, as I recall, Your Honor, I think I made the offer of proof on the record.
He said he was going to testify to something about the pay for the people to be there in time, and then also made some reference to the clamp, I think.
Right. He was going to testify about the procedures to get the vessel ready because the vessel had been winterized, and that was one of the issues that I made an offer of proof on. He was both captain and engineer. He could have cleared up the issue. The jury was concerned because
He could have testified on the issue. He would have been cross-examined, of course.
Yes.
And he had some interest in the situation, and he was related to John.
Correct.
Maybe the jury would have believed him, and maybe they wouldn't.
Correct. That's correct.
So what you have now is an affidavit that's not the result of cross-examination. It's just what he would say.
Precisely.
Would have said.
Yeah. One of the issues on appeal was that the exclusion of the captain's testimony was harmful and prejudicial to plaintiff's case because that's evidenced not by what the note the jury sent to the court. The jury says, why are we as a jury not hearing from Rick Johnson?
But the issue is whether the district court abused its discretion in not permitting that witness to be called at that point in the case, given the showing that you made at the time you requested that he testify. That's really the issue, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's part of the issue, but it is the issue, Your Honor. But also, this Court's holding in Simeona v. Heiner, the Court went a step further because I think that was the issue in Simeona. The district court had reduced by 50% the damage award. And this Court said in Simeona v. Heiner that we depart from our history and that if a seaman is injured while following a direct order from the superior officer, we do not apply the comparative fault rule. But I think also in Simeona and also in Farr v. Ensign Machinery, it seems to me that what this Court was saying is that as a matter of law now, we are not going to assess comparative fault. So my argument, at least I think I made the argument fairly clear, is that in this case, the real issue should have been not a defense verdict, but at least what if the jury chose not to believe the plaintiff, as a matter of law, it should be serve as a mitigation of damage compared to fault because there's no – say Ron John was the engineer. Say he loosened that hose clamp accidentally forgot to tighten it. Wouldn't that be assumption of the risk? I mean, this court said no matter how egregious seaman's negligence is, it doesn't serve as a bar to recovery. It serves only to mitigate damages. The Supreme Court said that in Sofic, Exxon versus Sofic. It was followed by this circuit in Farr versus NC Machinery. And it was carried a step further in Simeona versus Heiner.
But you get to that only if you find negligence or unseaworthiness in the first place, don't you?
Well,
otherwise, there's no point to even consider contributory negligence.
Well, that's correct. In this case, if plaintiff would have been given the transitory language instruction in Mitchell v. Trawler Racer, the jury would have had a proper jury instruction to connect plaintiff's argument to.
Why wasn't instruction number 18 sufficient to inform the jury that they could find unseaworthiness as a temporary matter? That instruction says the seaman cannot recover for a temporary unseaworthy condition created solely by the seaman's own negligence or breach of any employment duty. And from that instruction, it would seem obvious that he could recover for a temporary unseaworthy condition that wasn't created by his own negligence.
Yes. Well, I believe for two reasons that instruction did not was improper and did not cover this case properly. One is because my reading of Mitchell v. Trawler Racer, that jury instruction is improper because Mitchell is very clear that transitory conditions permit recovery. Now, secondly, the other part of the language that you just recited talks about not being able to recover for the seaman's own negligence. That theory seems to me to be a primary duty rule argument. This court in Moore versus the Sally J has said that argument is a disfavored defense. It should only apply when there's an express breach of an employment duty by a licensed officer. Because the logic being, every time a seaman gets injured on a boat, the boat owner or captain can say, he should have known better. He should have not done it that way. It's his own fault. So this court recognized that argument and said, if we're going to bar a seaman from its own recovery because he's at fault, or he breached a term and condition of his employment, i.e. engineer, say Ron was the engineer, then it better be expressed in his contract, it better be crystal clear that his contract said he was the engineer and these were his duties, and he must be a licensed officer who accepts that duty. I believe that it's a disfavored defense. That's my position. So that jury instruction is flawed for those two reasons. It misstates Mitchell. It misstates the Sally J. Moving on just briefly. Harmful error for denial of the transitory condition argument in the jury instruction, because that's what we really had. We had a condition that happened without notice. It happened only for a short period of time. I believe that's a transitory condition. I believe that's what the Supreme Court meant in Mitchell. I believe the court abused its discretion by not allowing the captain to testify. In this case, it allowed a reasonable jury to, I believe, conclude that Ron Johns had no credibility because Captain Johnson was offered as a witness, referred to an opening. The captain's going to testify about what happened. The captain had been on the boat for a year. The captain stayed with the vessel after the incident. The jury obviously was very concerned about that. They wrote a note. It's in the docket. why and when are we not hearing from Captain Johnson? No response from the court. There was simply the court chose not to respond, as I recall what happened. So I think it left the jury at the end of the day saying the jury, the plaintiff's argument isn't supported by what he promised, and the jury instructions to make the argument of transitory unseaworthiness and a breach of the other one, the one that was equivalent to Simeona versus Heiner. I used the Hall versus American Steamship instruction, which I think it basically states that a seaman is not at fault for his injury unless when he's following a direct order, unless he spurns a safer alternative. In other words, if the seaman's told to go across the deck and tie up the boat and he sees a bucket of oil that just spilled on the deck and he decides to run through the oil as opposed to going around it, he shouldn't recover if he does something, you know, spurns a safer alternative. In this case here, there was simply no evidence that there were, considering the vessel was almost capsizing, that there was a safer way to do the jobs that he was told to do, and that he spurned a safer choice.
You want to reserve the remainder of your time?
Yes, I'd like
to. Rebuttal?
I've got 3:36 left. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. My name is Mario Madden. I represent the defendants, Misty Blue, in this case. I think we need to keep in mind what plaintiff is asking you to do here. He's asking you to set aside a verdict arrived after months of litigation and 6-day trial, a verdict in favor of the defendant, based on arguments that, for the most part, weren't preserved below. I want to work through each of the 4 assignments of error quickly, and just explain why they're not well taken. First of all, plaintiff assigns error to the trial court's failure to instruct on a transitory unseaworthiness condition. First of all, I want to point out that this, as well as his other assignment of error about a jury instruction, was not adequately preserved.
Why was that? I'm looking at transcript page, I guess it's supplemental excerpts of record 044. And we have Mr. Urey saying, in discussing the jury instruction, I just also wanted to take exception to the rejection of the Mitchell v. Trawler racer instruction. Transitory conditions, even those that exist for only a few moments, may constitute unseaworthiness. And then he also objects to the fact, following that the district court didn't give the other instruction he submitted. So, frankly, I don't see the basis for your argument that he didn't preserve those instructions.
Well, Your Honor, I agree that the objection was made pro forma. However, I would...
What do you mean pro forma? The objection was made.
But the objection requires more than just an objection. It also requires a specific explanation as to why.
He cited cases. That's not a sufficient explanation? I really think that's the weakest argument you have, because we have it on the record that he made this objection. So let's look at some of your others.
The second reason why that instruction, the transitory condition instruction, was unnecessary is something you put your finger on. The concept of transitory unseaworthiness was encompassed within the instructions that were given to the jury. The general seaworthiness instruction number 17, is broad enough to encompass the idea of a temporary.
Well, if that's so, now, did you oppose the transitory seaworthy instruction that Mr. Urey submitted? Were you at the trial?
Your Honor, I have to admit I was not at the trial.
Oh,
I don't know if that's...
Well, I assume you opposed it because the court didn't give it. But I don't see how instruction 18 really makes it clear to the jury that they could find unseaworthiness from a transitory condition, given that it says it doesn't really directly say that. You really have to make an inference from that.
Your Honor,
aren't we supposed to give really clear instructions to a jury so they know how they're supposed to view the evidence before them?
We're supposed to give instructions that do adequately allow them to assess the evidence. That's correct.
Did it adequately reflect the theory of the case?
I think it did if you look in conjunction with number 17, which talks about seaworthiness in general. And it says, and this is our supplemental excerpt of record 45, a vessel is unseaworthy if the vessel or any of its parts or equipment is not reasonably fit for its intended purpose. And I think there's nothing in here that restricts that to any particular temporal
situation. But there's nothing there that says that you can find unseaworthiness if it arises on a transitory basis, as Mitchell instructs.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, but I think it's clear that, as you pointed out in Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, that a court doesn't have to use the exact words proposed by a party. It just has to give the instruction to allow the jury to intelligently determine the issues presented.
Right. And that's what I'm wondering about, because there's nothing that directly talks about how, and I'm not familiar with maritime law, so when I read the instruction, there was nothing there that said to me really clearly this whole notion of the transitory nature of unseaworthiness is a possibility as a basis for holding the ship owner liable.
I think your reading might be stronger if there was something in there that would restrict the jury from finding a temporary unseaworthy condition. I think if there were some instruction that had been given that said that it had to exist when it left the dock, or it couldn't have been something that happened on the way, if there had been instruction like that, perhaps there would be confusion. Our point is that given the instructions that were presented to the jury could have looked at the vessel at the time of the incident and looked at the video that was presented to them, listened to the testimony that was presented, and said, boy, that vessel at that point isn't fit for its purpose. It's unseaworthy.
I gather this was your argument, that somehow Mr. Johns was culpable for making it unseaworthy by whatever he did with the loose hose clamp on the freshwater tank.
Well, that is certainly part of our argument. Our argument was that if there was an unseaworthy condition, and we don't concede that this was an unseaworthy vessel at that point. Plaintiff has said that it's undisputed. I disagree with that. No one has conceded this was unseaworthy. In fact, the jury found exactly the opposite. And we're not saying that that was incorrect. The jury was entitled to find that, look at the evidence, weigh that factual decision and that factual determination, decide at that point whether it was seaworthy or not. However, if it did find that it was unseaworthy, it's our position, and this is our second argument as far as there's no prejudice here, because there was evidence presented that Mr. Johns was the engineer of this vessel. And granted, he denies that, but the jury's entitled to listen to him and listen to the evidence and make their own conclusion. That he was the engineer of the vessel, he would have been responsible for that hose clamp, and he failed to do his duty. And therefore, whatever happened to this vessel was his fault. And under Instruction 18, which I would remind the Court came in without objection from the plaintiff, although he's now claiming that it is an improper instruction.
I think his argument on that is that was okay to be given, but you should have also given something else.
Okay. I didn't hear. I heard him say that it was an improper instruction, period. But regardless, it came in without objection. And based on the instructions that were before the jury, which are the law of the case, regardless of whether they're legal or not, as long as they're unobjected to, the jury would have found, more probably than not, that it was his fault that this happened.
So is just to understand this unseaworthiness concept.
Yes.
Okay, let's assume that the hose. Okay, let's assuming that when the ship left the dock, the hose was adequately secured. It was the way it was supposed to be when it left the dock. So the ship is seaworthy then.
Okay.
Okay.
Assuming that.
Okay. Assume that. Yeah. No. It's just for sake for argument. Okay, and then assume that somehow Mr. Johns did something that unloosened the hose clip. Does that make the vessel unseaworthy, or is it still seaworthy because it's still fit for its intended purpose?
Well, seaworthiness is admittedly a somewhat squishy issue. It's a factual determination that you look at the entirety of the vessel at the point, or if it's a particular thing like slipping on a ladder or something, you look at that. But in this case, I would argue it's the entirety of the vessel. You look at the vessel, and it has to be a determination whether it could be reasonably used for its intended purpose at that point.
And its intended purpose would be the fishing trip it intended to take. Was that it?
Well, I think it could be the fishing. I don't know if it has to be exactly fishing at that point, because they weren't fishing at that point. They were heading out to the
To have a boat be reasonably to be seaworthy, I guess that's in a it's not in perfect condition,
correct,
but it's reasonably adequate or whatever for the purpose intended. And the purpose intended was to have the boat go out and get some crabs and come back, I think.
Correct. That was it was on
a crab. So a jury would have to find that the boat fit that definition of seaworthiness. Certainly it could while it was at the dock. And if later on out to sea the clamp comes off, the boat nevertheless could have been reasonably fit at the time it was at the dock.
Correct.
And the clamp just came off.
Well, Your Honor, that's correct. And in fact, there's case law out there, and unfortunately I don't have it right in front of me, that says that things that happen on sea voyages that are a result of the usual effect of the sea voyage are not unseaworthy conditions. Now, whether or not this is that, that's up to the jury to determine. I think that's what I keep coming back to.
Well, that seems to me is that you have to argue, because it seems to me that you were not the trial lawyer.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The trial lawyer said, well, I think he said it was unseaworthy. I'm not sure from the record, but I think he said it was unseaworthy, but it was John's fault that it was. But the only testimony on that was the prior engineer. I can't remember his name.
It was the prior captain.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't pronounce it even if I could.
Frank. Yes.
Okay, let's call him Frank.
Frank, that works.
Okay. Anyway, he said, in October, the captain and I looked at that, and I saw it was properly installed, and it was perfect, and these things don't come off by themselves. It was wonderful. That was his testimony.
Essentially, yes.
Okay. Now, there was no testimony contrary to that. I think there was speculation.
Do you mean as to the fact that it was in working, perfect working condition in October? There was, as far as I was aware from reading the record, no testimony contradicting that. You're right.
Yeah, so if you tell you there's no testimony of that, then you had a good clamp at the time you left the dock, and these things don't normally come off unless somebody's fiddled with them or something or other. Say, okay, well, that's fine. This one maybe did. But I suppose on that basis, a jury could find that the vessel was seaworthy. I don't know.
I think you're right, Your Honor, and that's what Farenkopf's testimony allows him to do. This vessel was, by all accounts, in perfect shape when it left. Someone must have fiddled with it.
And there was no evidence to the contrary to his testimony. Is that correct?
Not that I saw on the record, no, Your Honor. I'm sure if there is plenty of...
Okay, let me skip you over a little bit, and I don't mean to... But there's a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you've argued that well in your pleadings and all. But on the motion for new trial, that's where the judge, the old saying used to be, sits as the 13th juror, and the judges say, no, I don't sit as the 13th juror, but I will weigh the evidence and look at it, and I'll make a determination on the new trial motion.
Correct, Your Honor.
And as I'm reading the judge's decision, it's in the supplemental excerpt. I got the wrong document. Anyway, I get it. You probably already have it because you've been worrying about it. But it's at SER. SER. I extracted it from the record. The order denying plaintiff's motion for a new trial, JNOV. I didn't find in here, in this document, anything about the judge talking about the evidence of the trial and weighing on the new trial motion, whether the evidence was sufficient to support, whether the jury could have come to this conclusion under the evidence. I don't find
it. No, he did not specifically address that. He did say that plaintiff's position would require the jury to, or require him to ignore Farenkopf's testimony, if I remember correctly, Your Honor. Unfortunately, I don't have that document right in front of me. But I do think he made a comment that, at least at the end, after he gets through all the misconduct stuff, which is really the primary ground for the 59 motion, that he does say something to the effect that there was that the jury could have listened to Farenkopf. And I'm sorry, I don't have that.
Oh, I see. In any event, there's no reason for the court to disregard Farenkopf's testimony. What happened on the Misty Blue what injuries are inherently factual questions that were explored thoroughly in the evidence and on cross-examination. The court cannot say that construing the evidence most favorably to the defendants, the only reasonable conclusion was contrary to the verdict. That doesn't seem to be the new trial language.
Except, well, Your Honor, I think that the new trial language is even stronger. I think if you look at the case law governing the new trial, NFRC 59, it's going to be reversed only if there's an absolute absence of evidence to support a jury's verdict.
I see. Well, and maybe that is stronger. Maybe that is enough.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Even though he stuck it under.
But isn't motion for judgment as a matter of law a higher standard?
Yes, Your Honor. It gets a little confusing because the motion was entitled one thing, a certain rule was cited in the motion 59, FRCP 59, then an appeal the plaintiff cites FRCP 50B. Those are two entirely different rules. FRCP 50B is what is known as a renewed judgment for matter of law. And in that situation, it is reviewed de novo. And you're looking for substantial evidence to support the verdict, and that is, you look at to see if reasonable people could differ and if a reasonable person could come to that conclusion the jury came to. Two things wrong with that. Here I do think I have a preservation argument, Your Honor. There was no motion for directed verdict made below at all by plaintiff after his close of his trial, at the close of his evidence or at the end of the trial. FRCP 50B clearly requires that. The case law clearly requires that. So in order to challenge the substance, the sufficiency of the evidence under 50B, you need to make a directed verdict motion. Plaintiff didn't. Now, plaintiff, so his.
You didn't argue that, did you?
Yes, I did argue that, Your Honor. You're looking, it's in my brief.
Oh, you argued it, but I mean at the trial, when the trial lawyer was arguing to the court, he didn't cite the Rule of 50 violation.
Well, he may not have in our responsive papers to the motion. However, Your Honor, I think we're entitled to raise alternative grounds for affirmance on an appeal. So even if it wasn't particularly raised in our opposition to the motion, I think it's fair for us to raise it here. That's his argument on appeal, which I think is disregarded. Wasn't preserved. Now, below, he did cite FRCP 59, which is a motion for new trial. And the motion for new trial is a whole different matter. That's been called, and when they challenge the motion for new trial, is to look at if it's against the evidence and not just sufficiency evidence. And that's why this higher standard applies. That is, you have to look at whether there was an absolute absence of evidence to support the jury's verdict. And that's cited in the Samen case, which is 173 F3rd. It's at site 1154, note 5. And in fact, it's an FRCP 59 motion, denial of an FRCP 59 motion is referred to as virtually unassailable by Justice White. It was quoted in that particular footnote. So I think the motion for new trial, and plaintiff seems to be making two arguments here, and I frankly can't quite get my arms around them, whether he's claiming a sufficiency of evidence or claiming it should have been a new trial. Either one, he loses. If it's sufficiency of evidence under 50B, he didn't preserve it. If it's FRCP 59, motion for new trial, there's clearly evidence in the record to support a conclusion in this. There has to be absolutely no evidence. Perhaps if the boat were laying at the bottom of the ocean, maybe the argument could be made. And even that I'm not going to concede. But the jury looked at the evidence that was presented, as the judge pointed out, all the videotape, all the testimony, everything that was presented, Fahrenkopf's testimony, plaintiff's testimony, and said, there's no reason for a new trial here. There's not an absolute absence of evidence, which is what he would have to have found in order to reverse and grant a new trial. And that's what that's the standard.
What if we didn't agree with you? What do we do?
Don't agree with me?
Yeah.
You don't have to agree with me. You have to agree with the jury.
Well, one of the thoughts might be that we would send it back and let the district judge consider the motion for new trial and consider it according to the law that may be applicable to new trial motions.
Obviously, Your Honor, the court is entitled. Whether I agree with it or not is not the point. I think that would be incorrect. I think that the court has to look at the verdict and determine whether there's an absolute absence of evidence. And then if there is, in the court's mind, which I don't think could possibly be concluded here, but if it is, then it's remanded back for a new trial. I don't know if a remand back to the district court to look at the evidence again after the district court already said that it did. I'm not sure what that would achieve.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly it's within the power to do with whatever is necessary, but I don't think that would achieve anything. It would just be a waste of time. I would like to just quickly talk about the Rick Johnson matter. First of all, there was no meaningful offer of proof made, and the offer, well, let me just set the stage quickly here. Rick Johnson could have been called at any time during plaintiff's case in chief. He claims that the opportunity was postponed due to a rescheduling error or rescheduling situation. That's not clear in the record. There's no record citations of that. But even if that were the case, plaintiff had up to 5 days to do their trial. They could have called Rick Johnson at that time. He didn't. Then
he did, but he couldn't testify, wasn't that it? I mean, he was held, and he left.
I understand he was there, but I don't know if he was actually called.
Well, that's not in the record.
But I can't. There's nothing in the record about that.
Okay.
And then after defense had gone through most of their trial, the jury sent in this note on the next to last day of trial saying, what about Rick Johnson, essentially?
Yeah.
The court at that time said we were going to say he's unavailable. The plaintiff agreed with that at that point. Said, that sounds good to me, essentially. The next day, on the last day of trial, when defendants were summing up their last witness, the plaintiff comes in and says, I want to call this rebuttal witness. And the court essentially said, it's too late. You had your chance. And even on the grounds that he wanted to bring him in for the plane tickets and the winterizing of the pump, that's not anything close to what he has in his declaration, which is all kinds of things. And I would also like to point out that the declaration was properly struck by the court as not being in accordance with the rules, and there's no error assigned to that. So it's our position the declaration is not even in the record before this court. And so the plaintiff cannot rely on that. If there are no further questions, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you,
counsel.
Thank
you very much.
Thank you. Just to sum up and reply briefly, with respect to Rick Johnson, there was mention in the record because I had a discussion with the trial judge about Rick Johnson being out in the hall for a day, but he wasn't able to testify because a doctor for the defendant was called out of order as a matter of professional courtesy. I agreed with Mr. Markovich to let that doctor testify so he could leave. That was in the record as part of my discussion with the court when I made a motion for I made two different motions, one an offer of proof, and then later when I made the motion for a new trial, JNOV, I actually had the affidavit, which I believe fairly well corroborated what my offer of proof was. So I think the record does show that Captain Johnson was available on two occasions at the court.
Did you actually call him as a witness?
He was identified. Yes, I did.
You said?
I said, Your Honor.
Was that in the rebuttal or was that in your case? Did you call him?
I was, as I recall, I was ready to call Mr. Johnson as a witness in plaintiff's case in chief. Mr. Markovich said, Mr. Urey, we have this doctor that, you know, is on standby here. We need to get him in and out of here. So as a matter of professional courtesy, Mr. Johnson didn't testify. I believe that in the morning, every day, I believe I gave a list of witnesses for that day to the judge. Mr. Johnson was on that witness list for that day. That got changed as a matter of courtesy to defense counsel, so he wouldn't have to pay the extra money to have the doctor come back later.
Did the defense counsel object when you asked to call Mr. Johnson in a rebuttal?
Yes, he did. He objected, and I believe that's when I made my offer of proof, which was later followed by the affidavit. Next, I think, which is important, page 5 of my reply brief, I cited what this Ninth Circuit followed when they applied the standard in Exxon versus Sofic, the Supreme Court case. They said this court in Farr applied the clearly erroneous standard applied in Exxon versus Sofic, Inc. as not meaning no review at all. Rather, this court ruled as a matter of law, Farr's failure to exercise care for his own safety is not a superseding intervening cause of his injuries, and that's not a bar to recovery. I think that language that the Ninth Circuit adopted is from the Supreme Court is very relevant here because it takes away some of the arguments about what is the proper standard of review? Is it abuse of discretion? Is it review de novo? Is this issue exclusion, et cetera? I went through that time and time again. I think this Court said that when it comes to the issue of whether a seaman caused his own injury or is responsible for his own injury, the Court, as a matter of law, is not going to apply assumption of the risk, and they're not going to apply the strictest standard of no review. I think that's what happened in the Lasfar case. The facts of that case were where Lasfar was standing underneath a piece of engine block that he ordered to be lifted over his head, and the hook came out and it injured his foot. This court in Seattle found that he assumed the risk by standing in an improper place, or he was at fault for his own injury. The Ninth Circuit said no. Even if his own negligence was egregious, even if he was at fault for not standing where he shouldn't have been, or like in this case of Johns, didn't properly apply the hose clamp tight, that doesn't bar recovery as a matter of law. It only serves to mitigate his damages. That's why I believe this Court should reverse. If there's any reason amongst other reasons, that is one of the fundamental reasons why this case should be reversed, because it goes against the Supreme Court's ruling in Exxon. It goes against Farr, and it also even goes against Simeona versus Heiner, because this Court went a step further a couple of years ago in Simeona when they said, when you're following orders, you're not comparatively at fault. Doesn't that also mean that there isn't fault? I mean,
Yes, Counsel, you're over your time. We've read the cases. Thank you very much. All right. Johns versus Misty Blue is submitted, and we'll take up Washington State Department of Transportation versus Seacoast Towing.